It's Wednesday, March 19, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Well, it was just a matter of a couple of weeks ago when the cultural and ideological left was celebrating the defeat of a special bill in Arizona that would have granted religious liberty rights to those who had conscience concerns about serving same-sex weddings. The cultural left, joined by the mainstream media, celebrated the defeat of the legislation when Arizona Governor Jan Brewer vetoed it as a major victory against what they called Jim Crow laws. It was a vile misrepresentation of the legislation, and it was, most alarmingly, a very casual and even celebrated dismissal of the basic religious liberty rights of Americans. But now even some on the cultural left are beginning to wonder if they took the right position. Perhaps after listening to the chatter on the cultural left, they've begun to wonder if they've created a bigger problem than they ever had imagined. Two articles appeared just in recent days that make this point very eloquently, one of them in USA Today, the other an opinion column in the Wall Street Journal. The column in the Wall Street Journal is by two legal scholars. The first is Eugene Volokh, a professor of law at UCLA. The second, Ilya Shapiro, who's a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute. They have entered into the litigation over this issue, filing a brief supporting Elaine Photography's petition for a review by the United States Supreme Court. Elaine Photography, as you will remember, is the wedding photography firm in New Mexico that has been found guilty of discriminating against same-sex couples when Elaine Huguenin refused to photograph a same-sex wedding ceremony, saying that it would have violated her Christian convictions. It would have required expressive speech by her participation as a photographer. As Volokh and Shapiro write, "We support the extension of marriage to same-sex couples, yet too many who agree with us on that issue think little of subverting the liberties of those who oppose gay marriage. Increasingly, legislative and judicial actions sacrifice individual rights at the altar of anti-discrimination law," end quote. This is a very important article because it's written by two legal scholars who are supportive of the legalization of same-sex marriage, but they're very concerned about the violations of religious liberty that this new movement is about to create. They write, "Consider the case of the New Mexico wedding photographer, Elaine Photography, which the Supreme Court is now deciding whether to take. The case is known as Elaine Photography versus Willock." Volokh and Shapiro say they expect the Supreme Court to announce whether it will take the case on or about March the 21st. But they go on to write that the commission, that is in New Mexico, found against Elaine Photography, ordering its owners, Jonathan and Elaine Huguenin, to pay $6,600 in attorney fees because they refused to violate their convictions by commemorating through photography a same-sex wedding ceremony. But even as lawyers Volokh and Shapiro have entered a brief in support of Elaine Photography, they're not just concerned about Elaine Photography. As a matter of fact, they're not just concerned about photographers, and they're certainly not concerned just about those who have convictional problems with same-sex marriage. They cite a decision by the United States Supreme Court in 1977, known as Woolley versus Maynard. They call it the Live Free or Die decision because it had to do with a license plate case out of New Hampshire. And in that case, the Supreme Court ruled that the First Amendment, quote, includes both the right to speak freely and the right to refrain from speaking at all, end quote. As Volokh and Shapiro warn in this column, the kind of logic and the kind of coercion used against Elaine Photography in New Mexico can be used against anyone. They write, "Take, for instance, a freelance writer who declines to write a press release for a religious organization with which he disagrees. By the reasoning of the New Mexico Supreme Court, the writer has violated the law because his refusal to write the press release is discrimination based on religion, much as Elaine Huguenin's refusal to photograph an event with which she disagreed was treated as violating the law." Volokh and Shapiro then warn that a writer must have the First Amendment right to choose which speech he creates, notwithstanding, they say, any state law to the contrary. They go on to say the same is true of photographers who create a visual expression. Quote, "The U.S. Supreme Court has said repeatedly that the First Amendment protects an individual freedom of mind, which the government violates whenever it tells a person that she must or must not speak." They conclude, quote, "Forcing a photographer to create a unique piece of art violates that freedom of the mind," end quote. The two legal scholars conclude their argument with these words, quote, "The First Amendment secures an important right to which all speakers are entitled, whether religious or secular, liberal or conservative, pro or anti-gay marriage. A commitment to legal equality can't justify the restriction of that right," end quote. So Volokh and Shapiro are basically writing from the worldview of libertarianism, and they are very clearly concerned that basic civil liberties are at stake when the left is pressing an agenda of coercion against those with whom it disagrees. The other very important article appeared in yesterday's edition of USA Today. It's by Oliver Thomas, identified as a member of the Board of Contributors to USA Today and formerly chairman of the Coalition for the Free Exercise of Religion, which was the very coalition that drafted what became known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Thomas also writes as a supporter of the legalization of same-sex marriage, but he writes, quote, "Now most of America's religious institutions still consider marriage between members of the same sex to lie beyond the scope of God's will. No doubt that will change. Just a short time ago, a majority of Americans opposed gay marriage. Today's young people seem to care less." But he writes, as the culture changes, what of the religious freedom laws that allow people to act on these anti-gay beliefs even as their ideas are rejected by an emerging majority of Americans? And what of the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act being used to challenge Obamacare's mandate that employers provide contraceptives as part of their health plans, and which will be argued before the Supreme Court next week? End quote. Now, what makes this article really significant is that Oliver Thomas was indeed the head of the coalition that brought about the passage in 1993 of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That act was known as a piece of remedial legislation. That is, it's a law intended to fix something. And what it was intended to fix is an imbalance in the law that was brought about in 1990 by the Supreme Court case known as the Smith decision. That decision was understood by both the left and the right to be a severe violation of religious liberty. Then Thomas picks up the story, quote, "So a sprawling coalition of religious and civil liberties groups, ranging from the ACLU to the National Association of Evangelicals, joined forces with congressional oddfellows Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch to remedy the problem. With only 3 dissenting votes, Congress restored the protections the Supreme Court had jettisoned. More than a dozen states did the same. The new laws were no stalking horse for bigotry. They protect the most fundamental American rights of all, freedom of conscience," end quote. Now, this article is vitally important, first of all, because it sets the record straight. It points out that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that very act that in state form was so bitterly criticized in the national media and by the cultural left just a matter of 2 or 3 weeks ago, was actually passed in 1993 by an amazing coalition of people from the right and the left, including the National Association of Evangelicals and the American Civil Liberties Union, including sponsorship by Senator Ted Kennedy of the left and Senator Orrin Hatch of the right. It passed Congress with only 3, count them, 3 dissenting votes. You didn't hear anything about that, not in the national media, when all the controversy about Arizona was swirling about, just a matter of days ago. Oliver Thomas is an experienced religious liberties litigator. He is not only the one who was chairman of the coalition that brought about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, I also knew him when he was general counsel of the Baptist Joint Committee on Public Affairs. He is not a conservative, but he is an honest man on this issue, and his honesty deserves our very close attention. Over the past several years, in various articles, I have cited the moral philosopher and historian Kwame Anthony Appiah, who is a professor at Princeton University. I've cited Professor Appiah because he's a scholar of moral revolutions, and as we've been talking about the moral revolution over the issue of human sexuality, and especially the issue of homosexuality and same-sex attraction, I have cited him because he's done the most important intellectual work on how moral revolutions happen. But at least heretofore, he hasn't applied that to the issue of homosexuality. But he has now. In an interview given to the Louisville Courier-Journal, he does exactly that. He refers to homosexuality in the context of the moral revolutions he's been tracing by pattern. He was asked the question, "Do you consider the movement to grant marriage rights to same-sex couples a moral revolution?" He then answered, "Yes. At the heart of homophobia was the shaming of homosexuals. Part of what's happened since the Stonewall Rebellion is a retreat from shame, and that's been a very big honor shift. Among young people now," he says, "in most of the country, it's considered not just wrong, but actually shameful and discrediting to be homophobic. That's typical of these big moral changes. It comes to seem not just wrong, the old way of doing things, but it actually serves to discredit you. People who know people of a certain identity and work with them and do things with them and see them around, it's harder for them to feel hatred or contempt for people of that identity," end quote. Now, there are some very big problems with what Professor Appiah has to say here. For instance, he simply identifies all opposition to the normalization of homosexuality as homophobia. That's intellectually dishonest, but that's not actually the point of his statement. The point of his statement is that the great moral change now taking place on the issue of homosexuality, and particularly on the issue of same-sex marriage, is actually a moral revolution on the same scale that he has documented for so many other issues in other centuries. But there's something else of tremendous importance embedded in his comments. I've cited repeatedly Theo Hobson of Britain, who points out that in a moral revolution, it isn't enough that what was condemned is now celebrated. It has to proceed to the point that those who refuse to celebrate are now condemned. That's where Professor Appiah's comments about honor become particularly important. He says, in this moral revolution, as in others, those who hold the position that is no longer in the mainstream, and in this case, he would mean those who oppose the normalization of homosexuality, are seen not only as wrong, but as dishonorable. That's a very important insight, and I think most of us already perceive that it is true. This represents, of course, an enormous challenge to the Christian church and to all those who hold to a revealed morality and to biblical authority on the issue of sexual morality. This is indeed a huge challenge. And even though it is not good news, it is important that we understand the truth of the challenge that we face. In this particular interview, Professor Appiah helps us to understand the scale of the problem. But by referring to all opposition to homosexuality as homophobia, he also helps to create the problem. And I'm sure he feels quite self-righteous in doing so, which, after all, is his very point. Yesterday's edition of the New York Times included a very important news analysis by Mark Landler having to do with the status of peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. As he writes, with time running out before an April 29 diplomatic deadline and no signs of progress in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, President Obama on Monday warned President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority that, quote, we're going to have to take some tough political decisions and risks if we're able to move it forward. End quote. But, as Landler reports, Abbas, speaking before a meeting in the Oval Office, made clear that he was no closer to uttering the words that are a litmus test for the Israelis, that he recognizes Israel as a Jewish state. Instead, Mr. Abbas said, as Mr. Obama looked on, quote, since 1988, we have recognized international legitimacy resolutions on Israel, and in 1993, we recognized the state of Israel, end quote. So what's missing here? The Palestinians are refusing to say the one thing that Israel demands they must say, that they recognize Israel not only as a state, but as a Jewish state. Why is that so important? Well, it's because if the Palestinians do not recognize Israel as a Jewish state, they are effectively announcing the fact that they intend eventually, by populating or by other means, to take over Israel and to make it no longer a Jewish state. This is why the Israelis know that this is a fundamental issue in these negotiations, an issue they have to stand by and stand fast upon if they are going to secure the safe future for Israel as a Jewish state. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as the New York Times rightly reports, has insisted that the Palestinians must recognize Israel as a nation-state for the Jewish people in order to get a peace deal. The Palestinians, on the other hand, have flatly refused, and on Monday, Mr. Abbas made very clear he's not budging. This puts, as the New York Times makes very clear, President Obama in a very difficult position. But it's a position that the Obama administration has basically boxed itself into by the fact that it has created this deadline and is putting such pressure on Israel to negotiate with the Palestinians. In a summary statement that points to the scope of the issues, the New York Times reports, quote, the Israelis and the Palestinians continue to disagree over several other core issues. Mr. Abbas reiterated the Palestinian demand that East Jerusalem be the capital of a Palestinian state. With so much in dispute, analysts said, the focus on both sides now has shifted from bridging gaps to avoiding blame should the talks fail, end quote. As anyone who follows international diplomacy will immediately recognize, this means that it's already apparent that both sides have given up on an agreement. They're simply now deciding their strategy for playing the blame game. And that includes the American administration as well. It's going to have to point the finger at someone for the failure of these two sides to come together. But the two sides are actually separated by a complete set of incommensurate expectations and demands. The Palestinians see the Israeli demand that Israel be recognized recognized as a Jewish state as the end of their aspirations for regaining the territory, which is exactly what Israel understands and now demands. There are certainly many issues here to be negotiated, but the fact remains that Israel cannot be expected to sign its own death warrant, and that's exactly where many of these negotiations would actually lead. Israel's right in this respect. If its opponents do not recognize it as a Jewish state, not merely as a state, it will not be a Jewish state for long. And let's remember the historic fact that Israel is not a Jewish state merely because it has declared itself to be so. The United Nations declared it to be so when it allowed the creation of Israel and recognized it as a state, not merely as a state, but as a Jewish state. We can certainly understand Israel's refusal to participate in the rewriting of its own history at its own expense, to its own doom. Yesterday's edition of the New York Times also had a very important news article that appeared to be a piece of satire, only it isn't, and that's the profound point. The headline in the article by Campbell Robertson is this: after years in politics and then prison, Louisiana ex-governor to run for Congress. You won't be surprised to know that the ex-governor is Edwin Edwards, now age 86. This article reminds us that Edwin Edwards spent 7 years in Congress. Then he spent 16 years as governor of Louisiana. Then he spent 8 years in the federal penitentiary with charges of political corruption. On Monday, former Governor Edwards announced that he's going to be running as a Democrat to represent Louisiana's 6th congressional district. When asked at a very lively news conference why the 86-year-old former congressman, former governor, and former prison inmate is now running for Congress, he said, quote, "Everybody that I meet wants me to run for governor, which I'd like to do. But I'm prohibited by state law. But I'm qualified by the United States Constitution to run for Congress," end quote. So he is. According to the paper, he's going to be running as a rather conservative blue dog Democrat, holding to rather conservative political positions. He was asked for whom he voted for president in 2008. His response, quote, "I did not vote for Obama. Where I was at the time, there were no voting machines," end quote. As the Times explains, his post-prison life has hardly been quiet. He has gotten married and had a child. He's been touring the state signing copies of his biography, and he starred with his family in a reality television show known as The Governor's Wife. By the way, the governor's wife is 35. Remember, he's 86. They have an 8-month-old son. So the big question, of course, is this. Will the fact that he spent years in a federal penitentiary as he was found guilty of political corruption keep him out of office in this election? The Times attempted to answer that question by citing Richard Guidry, a former Democratic state legislator there in Louisiana. He said this, quote, "Edwards has always kept his popularity even when he was in jail. You have to be a unique person to do that," end quote. That seems to be something of an understatement. Speaking of federal prison, this particular man said, "That's the kind of thing that gets you defeated." Well, most people, but maybe not Edwin Edwards. Back when the former governor first went to the federal penitentiary, the joke was told that Louisiana sold its surplus voting machines to Mexico. The big surprise came when Mexico tallied its votes for its presidential election, and, you guessed it, Edwin Edwards was elected the president of Mexico. Well, that was a joke back then, but it might be no laughing matter now. It looks like the next chapter in this story is going to be written by the voters of Louisiana's 6th congressional district. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. Remember, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Call with your question in your voice to 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. This morning, I'll be speaking again at 10 o'clock in the chapel service at Cedarville University. Perhaps I'll have a chance to see some of you there. I'm speaking to you from Springfield, Ohio, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.